This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
The caregiving crisis. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
Employers are becoming more concerned about employees having to care for elderly parents. Hear how the workforce is being affected.
On the tech front, how close are we to personal robots that can do things like cook? One expert says 2019 is the year that everything changes.
On the personal finance front, the portfolio moves you might consider given the nature of the stock market these days.
And with the conference championships being played this weekend, a look at why the NFL can't lose with its quarterback matchups.
You have the two oldest quarterbacks in professional football, Tom Brady, who's 94 years old, Drew Brees, who's 92, or 40 and 41, if you want to put it that way, going up against Gen Y, going up against the youngest, most talented quarterbacks the NFL has to offer.
Wall Street Journal sports writer Jason Gay on the playoff storylines. He's here in about 25 minutes. Since the enactment of the Taft-Hartley Act back in 1947, federal employees have been legally prohibited from striking. But lawmakers who approved that measure likely did not envision a scenario where the government would require its employees to work without paying them, as is the case now. Another angle of the shutdown from Russell Berman, staff writer at The Atlantic. Russell, who are these workers?
Essential employees. These are TSA agents. These are corrections officers at the Bureau of Prisons. These are air traffic controllers. These are the Secret Service. And they have to go to work anyway, even though they are not currently being paid. That's putting a lot of financial strain on them, but they're not allowed to walk out because even though they're not being paid, federal law prohibits federal employees from going on strike or staging any kind of mass walkout.
Why is that? Why is that law in place?
That law has been in place since the Taft-Hartley Act in 1947, and you know, of course, that was designed in the era of big labor unions to prevent federal employees from using the leverage of a strike to demand higher pay, more benefits, better working conditions, where they would clearly have the power to shut down the government themselves or operations of the government. In this case, however, this is not federal employees bargaining for better pay. They're just asking to be paid, period. And so it's an open question whether, if this law was challenged in court, would it still apply in a situation where federal employees are not being paid at all, even though they will be paid, once the government reopens, whenever that might be.
Boy, could you imagine that chaos, right? TSA workers don't show up, Bureau of Prisons folks don't show up, air traffic controllers stay home. Wow.
Right.
That shutdown will be over
talking
tonight.
Talking to the leaders of their unions, they are encouraging them to go to work. There hasn't been any official talk of a walkout, and part of that is the memory of what happened the last time a federal employee union tried to strike, and that was in 1981 with the air traffic controllers,
yeah.
and Ronald Reagan famously fired them all, and that pretty much that message resonates today. And so if they were not to show up, they would be at risk for being considered absent without leave, and that would set off consequences that could lead up to and including their termination. And that, for long-time employees, could jeopardize their pension. So there is a lot of risk for federal employees if they don't show up. Now, we have seen reports, and the TSA has acknowledged that they are experiencing significantly higher rates of call-outs, some TSA agents essentially calling out sick while they're not being paid, and that is starting to affect the operations at some airports. And so we'll see if that increases as the shutdown goes on.
We're speaking with Russell Berman, staff writer at The Atlantic. He's written a piece entitled Why Federal Workers Still Have to Show Up Even If They're Not Being Paid. You know, there was a point made in your story, too, that struck me as part of the stressfulness of all this, and that's that some of these workers who are now not getting paid might not even have enough money for gas to get to work.
Right. So the TSA employees, the TSA agents, as well as the corrections officers at the Bureau of Prisons are among the lowest paid of the federal employees who are required to work. And so, you know, many of them are living paycheck to paycheck. They missed their last paycheck on Friday. So some of them, for example, if they can no longer afford child care, they have to decide whether to care for their children or show up for work. And certainly there are, in the prisons especially, many of them are located, the president of the union was telling me, many of them are located in rural areas, and there's a very long commute for the prison guards.
Thanks, Russell. It's Russell Berman, staff writer at The Atlantic. It is 12 minutes after the hour on this weekend. Hey, glad you could spend some time with us. Almost three-quarters of U.S. workers face some kind of caregiving responsibility, leading employees to battle competing interests. What's this mean for employers? Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
Caregiving responsibilities are expected to keep growing, and that will continue to take a toll in the workplace. David Harrison of the Wall Street Journal has more on a new Harvard study and joins us now. David, what does this survey tell us?
Well, it's really quite interesting. This is a survey that two researchers from Harvard Business School conducted, and they surveyed both employers and employees. And what they found was that employees report that the conflict, you know, the usual juggling between home and work, really takes a toll on people at work in ways that I think that they suggest that employers don't really realize. So, you know, they found that quite a lot of people who have caregiving responsibilities have actually left a job because they just couldn't make that balance work. Almost a third of people with caregiving responsibilities have left the job, they found. So they really it really seems that there is a there's this huge burden on folks, and the way they deal with that can have consequences for, you know, productivity at work, and can lead people to leave good jobs.
David, when we talk about caregiving, are we talking about just older people, or is it sometimes children, or both?
It's both. This survey kind of looked at you know, all sorts of caregiving, so it really didn't discriminate between kids or you know, elderly parents or relatives or spouses or anything like that. Basically, if you have a significant obligation at home, you're sort of included in this caregiving category.
But I would imagine that caregiving on the elder side is a growing problem as opposed to the kids.
Yes, that's right. So what's happening right now sort of in the broader sort of demographic picture in the U.S. is that, you know, the birth rate is shrinking, so they're you know, presumably going to be fewer kids around to take care of. And at the same time, the population of elderly people keeps rising. And so, you know, you combine those two, overall you're still going to get sort of more, you're going to have more people, more kids than elderly people to take care of in the coming years. That's just based on census projections. So every working-age American is going to have more people to take care of in the next few decades.
We're speaking with David Harrison of the Wall Street Journal. David, how did caregiving hurt some people's careers in this study?
So, you know, it's in the ways that you would expect. I mean, I'm sure everybody realizes how, you know, if you have kids at home, that it's always difficult to balance the two. And so, you know, people were either you basically can't make the two work, and so you quit your job. So that's a way to, that's a, definitely a career career drawback. Or people have said, I think 28% of the respondents in the survey said that it had hurt their careers, and because they either didn't get sort of challenging assignments and they felt less motivated at work, or they'd been passed over for raises or for promotions. Because, you know, there's this thing, you know, caregiving responsibilities kind of take it's not sort of the dramatic effects. I mean, it's also, you know, you have to leave early to pick up a sick kid, or you have to take a sick day, or you come into work and you're distracted because you're dealing with something at home. So all those things kind of add up, and that can make people less productive at work. And if you're less productive, chances are you're going to your path for advancement will be restricted somewhat.
Why do you think there's such a disconnect that employers don't realize sometimes that this is going on?
Yeah, so this is, I think, one of the really interesting conclusions of the survey was a study was that a lot of employers basically don't know what kind of responsibilities their workers face outside the home. It seems like there's this idea that, you know, among employers that what happens outside of work hours is none of their business. And that's something that I think what the authors of this survey suggest needs to change is that if employers don't know what their employees are dealing with at home, even the you know, even well-meaning employers who want to help, they just don't know what kind of benefits to offer or what kinds of things to do. So one of their recommendations was to basically conduct a sort of census among their employees to see what are you dealing with at home and how can we as employers, you know, who mean well, make it so that you can manage to balance work and home and you won't maybe have to quit your job or be more productive. So I think one of the most interesting conclusions is essentially employers just don't know, and they haven't been interested. They've been kind of slow in finding out. A lot of them said that they didn't want to. They were concerned about sort of violating employee privacy, or they just had no interest. And that's what these authors suggest needs to change.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenko with Wall Street Journal reporter David Harrison. 21 minutes after the hour. On this weekend, thanks for being with us. We are approaching critical mass on a number of technologies that we will see increasingly this year. This wave started at CES, where we saw an impressive number of attempts at personal robots and AI-powered digital assistants. Most will fail. However, tech analyst Rob Enderle at the Enderle Group says both the failures and the few successes will set the stage for the first true mobile personal robots that will arrive in the following years. Rob set this up.
So there are a lot of moving parts as we come into 2019. One of the big ones is personal robotics and the fact that we're now getting to near critical mass in terms of having the right skills, the right intelligence, and perhaps the right price point to build one of these things and have it in our house. This last week, NVIDIA opened a robotics lab, for instance, in Seattle to advance that that effort and actually create a robot we could look at. At CES, they had things that were kind of all over the map. They had some robots that could emote, but they couldn't move. They had other robots that could move, but didn't have hands and arms. And they had hands and arms that actually worked really well, but they weren't on any of the robots. So once again, showcasing that we have the parts, we're just kind of waiting for somebody to put the thing together.
So what would a personal robot do, ideally, in your home?
Well, at the NVIDIA event, they showcased robots that were prototypes, and what they could do is, for instance, if you were disabled, they could get stuff for you. They could put stuff away. Eventually, they'd be able to cook and prepare meals for you. So the kinds of things that you would typically have a servant do, the robot would do. The robots that NVIDIA was showcasing were basically arms on wheels. Not very human-looking, but I'm one of the folks that thinks that the first robots probably shouldn't be human-looking because you want them focused on doing the things you need to get done, and one of the things you don't need to get done is have some creepy human-looking thing wandering around your house in the middle of the night.
I get the idea of doing something like cooking, but to me it still seems like complex. It's got to bake a cake, so it doesn't know if you have enough flour or where the right pan is or where the frosting is. I don't know.
Yeah, well, that's all stuff that's being solved with artificial intelligence. So the interesting thing is much of the technology that went into getting cars to drive themselves is now being applied to robotics, and so they can read the labels on boxes. They certainly would have an internal database of recipes. At the very least, though, for somebody that's disabled, being able to grab a glass of water,
sure,
grab a snack out of the cabinet, maybe help you up if you've fallen, that kind of thing the robots are perfectly capable of doing, and that's probably where we're going to see them focused at first.
That would be impressive. How about the 5G revolution that you wrote about?
Well, so what 5G brings us is two things. We often talk about the one thing that everybody's focused on, which is more bandwidth, but the other thing it brings us is low latency. And low latency means you can do stuff in the cloud that you would typically do on your desktop. And Microsoft's coming forward with something called the virtual desktop, which would have your entire Windows experience in the cloud, and it would present itself on anything you had, anything from smart glasses to your smartphone to a traditional laptop computer, and then they would handle all the updates, patches, and make sure everything stayed working. I'm sure we would all miss terribly being an IT executive in our own house. I know I would. In any case, the fact is we're moving to a time when much of what we do that we typically would do on a local device like a PC will all be done in the cloud as a service, and that will give us a lot of flexibility in terms of where we work, how we work, and even why we work.
Hmm. We're speaking with Rob Enderle, tech analyst at the Enderle Group. He's principal and founder of that company, and he's written an interesting piece in Tech News World called 2019, The Year Everything Changes. All right, you wrote about artificial intelligence too, and you said, you know, it's been around in some form since the 1950s, and much of it has sucked. So how can we expect better things here?
Well, we came out with a concept called deep learning. IBM was calling it, I think, deep data, but same underlying concept. And deep learning goes steps away from machine learning. Machine learning is where programmers program a machine to be intelligent based on real-world events. What deep learning does is the machine programs itself. And that allows it to iterate at machine speeds because a computer can think thousands of times faster than we can. And so you get the human out of the loop, and suddenly the AI becomes very intelligent very quickly. And the areas where this is being applied are in areas like litigation, medicine, defense. Some of the advances in terms of defense are a little frightening at the moment, but at the end of the day, suddenly we're getting to a point where these things are actually smart, and they're smarter than the people that created them because they're training themselves. That really is a major jump in terms of the capability of artificial intelligence. It's one of the things that has a lot of us concerned, but a lot of us are very hopeful that the end result will be something that could actually cure cancer, yeah. Could actually provide a much, much greater, much better experience around much of what we do, but particularly with regard to medicine.
Thanks, Rob. Tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend.
Grainger stands for safety, and they know what safety stands for. S, safety. A, all about safety. F, feeling good about safety. E, extreme safety. T, talking about safety. Y, you guessed it, safety. First aid kits, eyewash stations, fire protection. You name it. For over 90 years, they've been helping to keep facilities safe and people safer. When it comes to safety, Grainger's got your back. Call or click Grainger.com to see for yourself. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
There's nothing small about your business. Your passion, your hours, your reputation, it's all huge. Your partnerships, even bigger. With Dell Small Business Technology Advisors, you'll get the tech, advice, and one-on-one partnership to help your business grow. Because with reliable Dell PCs with Intel Core processors, you can focus on what matters most, getting business done. Call 877-BUY-DELL to speak with an advisor today. That's 877-BUY-DELL.
Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Coming up this half hour, portfolio moves to consider. Also, is the polar vortex back this winter? And the NFL player who got a pick-me-up from a second grader. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes.
Seasons don't fear the reaper, nor do the wind, the sun, or the rain. We can be like they are. Come on,
there are some good storylines for this weekend's NFL Conference Championship games, especially when it comes to the quarterbacks. The early game Sunday features young Jared Goff and the LA Rams visiting the veteran Drew Brees in New Orleans. The second game is the young Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs on the road in Foxborough against veteran Tom Brady and the Patriots. More from Wall Street Journal sports writer Jason Gay. Jason, how do you see it?
Well, Gordon, you know, you and I have been around this business for a long time, and what we like in a news story is an easy setup, and boy, is it easy this weekend. You have the two oldest quarterbacks in professional football, Tom Brady, who's 94 years old, Drew Brees, who's 92, or 40 and 41, if I want to put it that way, going up against Gen Y, going up against the youngest, most talented quarterbacks the NFL has to offer in Patrick Mahomes of Kansas City and Jared Goff of the LA Rams. And it's old against new. It's yesterday against tomorrow. It's old parts versus the future, Gordon. And, you know, as storylines go, it doesn't get any fun, more fun and easier than that.
You referenced it in your story, too, about how Mahomes and Goff just seem to be ahead of the curve for such young quarterbacks, so advanced.
They are. And, you know, it's funny because Patrick Mahomes reminds people of, you know, Brett Favre, but also, you know, candidly, reminds people a little bit of Tom Brady in that he just seems born to do it. Goff, too. This is a guy who, you know, had a bumpy entry into the NFL, but has really played like a veteran for the last couple of seasons. And these are guys who aren't the typical growing pains that we associate with young quarterbacks. And you really do have to go back to a guy like Tom Brady to see, wow, you know, this guy just seems like this is what they're born to do.
Did you reference that Tom Brady has, like, University of Michigan sweatpants that are older than Mahomes or Goff?
You know, this article, as usual, is full of a lot of BS, but that sentence might actually be true. I mean, it's not out of the question that Tom Brady has University of Michigan Wolverine sweatpants that are older than 23-year-old Patrick Mahomes.
We're speaking of
22. He's 22?
Yeah.
23.
He's
young. He's younger than you and I, Gordon.
Frightening, I know. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal sports writer Jason Gay. His piece is called Tom Brady and Drew Brees, Beware the Zombie Geezers. As you point out, too, the NFL can't lose here. I mean, it's good storylines in both games.
It really is. It's set up really nicely for this weekend. You have, of course, the top two seeds in Kansas City and in New Orleans. And then you have, you know, terrific challengers and the Patriots, who looked incredible this past weekend against San Diego. This has been kind of an up and down season for the Patriots. I said San Diego, didn't I? It just won't die. The Chargers of Los Angeles, rather. And then over, of course, in the NFC, the Saints getting past the Eagles, and now they host the Rams, who got past the Cowboys. The Rams, another very, very talented young team. I mean, you can mix this up any way you want, and I think you're going to have a very attractive Super Bowl.
For the Patriots, the eighth straight conference championship game, but, as you say, they've lost three of these in a row on the road?
Yeah, well, you know, they've been in eight in a row, but the last three times they were forced to play the AFC championship game on the road, twice in Denver, once in Indy, they lost them all. So, you know, not a good omen for the Patriots. How funny is it, Gordon, that wackadoo play that the Miami Dolphins ran to beat the Patriots in Miami about a month ago? You know, remember that razzle-dazzle, yeah, double, you know, lateral kookiness that just pulled a rabbit out of the hat? That was the difference maker here, because the Patriots had a win over the Chiefs in the regular season. Had the Patriots just managed to hang on to that Dolphins game, they'd be looking at home field in Foxborough, where they're awfully hard to beat.
Thanks, Jason. It's Wall Street Journal sports writer Jason Gay. It's 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. We all have different financial situations and are at different stages in our lives, and that will drive how we react to certain financial situations. Here's what personal finance expert Jonathan Clements has been doing and plans to do, given the nature of the stock market today. He's the editor and founder of HumbleDollar.com. Jonathan, what did you look at?
It was my own portfolio. You know, much of the time, I don't pay much attention to my portfolio. I'm too busy doing other stuff. But as the stock market plunged late in the year, late in 2018, I took a look at where I stood, and what I discovered was that my asset allocation, the percentage of my portfolio that I have in stocks, had dropped to 62%. And for me, a neutral position is 70%. So clearly I was 8 percentage points below where I should have been. And as a consequence, late in the year and also a little bit early this year, I started doing some buying, trying to get back up to that 70%. And that's what I encourage everybody to do. Everybody should have written portfolio targets specifying what percentage of their portfolio they want to have in stocks, what percentage in bonds, and what percentage in cash investments.
All right, so you're in your mid-50s. I don't know, would you describe yourself as still being aggressive?
I would say that I'm sort of in the middle of the risk spectrum, in part because I consider myself to be semi-retired. I'm not actually living off my portfolio yet. I probably will be in the next 5 years or so, but I'm also not saving regularly. I'm just about covering the bills at this point in my career.
Yeah. All right, so when you looked at this and decided you wanted to bump up your stocks, you went to, what, 70%? That was your target?
Yes, 70% is my target, and as I said, that's what I consider to be a neutral allocation. My thought process, though, was what if this decline really accelerated? What if we got one of those great buying opportunities like we saw in late 2008 and 2009? What would I do? And after a looking at my portfolio and thinking about how much cash I would need in the years ahead, I decided I would be willing to go up as high as 80% stocks, but only if we really saw the market fall out of bed. Since then, of course, you know, we've seen the market come back. Now we're at 12 or 13% down from the all-time high we saw in September. Valuations are not as attractive as they were, but valuations actually are still reasonably attractive. We've got the S&P 500 trading in about 20 times trailing 12-month reported earnings, and that compares to a 50-year average of 19. So based on current valuations, based on price-earnings ratios, the stock market actually looks pretty close to fair value at this point.
We're speaking with Jonathan Clements. He's the founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. You said, too, great opportunities are becoming harder to spot. How come?
Well, one of the things that's happened over the last 30 years is the market's become increasingly expensive. You know, even if you go back to early 2009, after we saw that 57% drop by the S&P 500, even at that point, the stock market did not appear to be cheap. And today, again, the stock market does not appear to be cheap. Valuations have risen over time, and there are plenty of stories we can tell about why that is. And one of them is that people are simply more comfortable owning stocks today than they were 30 years ago, and as a consequence, they're happier to buy them at higher valuations. So while historically, you know, you would have thought a great buying opportunity might have occurred when stocks are trading at 10 or 12 times trailing reported earnings, probably we're never going to see valuations like that again.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. Back in the day, we used to call it winter. Now it's got its own catchphrase, the polar vortex, which could be making a return engagement. More on the popular term and what it actually means from weather reporter Doyle Rice at USA Today. Doyle, what is it exactly?
Well, it's one of those weather phenomenon that's really kind of taken a life of its own in the last few winters. I mean, the actual polar vortex is just kind of a spinning area of very cold air that usually lives where its name implies, up in the polar regions. And it's been there probably for billions of years, but it's only really kind of entered our the popular press and popular media in the last, I'd say, 5 or 6 years with some unusually cold spells that have spilled down from the poles down here into the U.S.
We start tossing around a phrase like polar vortex because the science is actually better, so we know a little more?
Meteorologists and scientists have used that term for decades, actually. It was usually kind of a more arcane term used in some of the scientific literature, but it only, as I said, only caught on recently. It's one of those things that it really sounds like some kind of made up for social media these days. It's very hashtag friendly, and so it's definitely something people are using a lot more when these Arctic outbreaks happen.
All right, so is it just as easy to say polar system as it is vortex?
I guess it would be, but it's more just kind of unspeakably cold air. It's just this mass of frigid air that sometimes sloshes down from the areas around the North Pole. It usually stays up there where it belongs, but due to various permutations of the jet stream and other factors, it can barrel its way down here across the central and eastern U.S. But it's probably a fine term to use if it is becoming a synonym for the very cold air.
Yeah. So the question then becomes: will we get some of this hashtag polar vortex this winter?
It looks like some forecasts are showing it. Where we are right now in a very mild pattern. Almost the entire continental U.S. is seeing above average temperatures after a very cold November and early December. We've kind of flipped the switch to kind of mild air for the next couple weeks. But there are some signs with the computer models that we could be getting a significant cold snap with help from the polar vortex towards the beginning to middle of January. Not necessarily surprising. That is typically the coldest part of the year, early to mid-January. So if it gets cold there, that wouldn't, it's not necessarily newsworthy.
Hmm. We're speaking with Doyle Rice, weather reporter at USA Today. His piece is called Polar Vortex. Back in the day, we called it winter. Is there a certain temperature range that says, "Oh, this is definitely a vortex, not just a cold snap"?
Just looking like it would be how much below average it is. Let's say your average temperatures this time of year, you'd say, you know, 30s and 40s across much of the central and eastern northeastern U.S. You know, when you're talking highs in the teens and 20s, which can happen, that's when you can usually use that term, because that is strictly polar Arctic air that's flowing down. And it mainly, I'd say if you have highs in the teens, 20s, as far south, let's say, as the mid-Atlantic, then you're probably in a vortex.
Thanks, Doyle. Doyle Rice, weather reporter at USA Today. 6 minutes in front of the hour on This Weekend.
Falls back, throws, intercepted, it went right through Jeffrey's hands. It's Lattimore!
The call on Fox by Kevin Burkhardt last weekend. Alshon Jeffrey was heartbroken after Sunday's loss to New Orleans, as his dropped pass with less than 2 minutes left led to a season-ending interception by the Saints. The For the Win blog at USA Today says while most Philly fans weren't happy with how things ended, one young fan, a second grader named Abigail Johnson, took some time in school to write a heartfelt letter to the wide receiver. She said, quote, "I'm a huge Eagles fan. When I watched the play, I was crying. It's okay to lose a game. You don't always have to win a game. We couldn't have won the Super Bowl without you last year. I think you are an awesome player no matter what. I love you." Abigail's father told Philly.com, "One of the things we want to teach our children is to work hard and compete graciously, but also to learn well and lose well." He said, Abigail responding to this way to a loss, "It's not the first time, but it's the first time she's done it on her own and in a written way, and we think that's excellent." That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.